Chapter 8. Home. It was a Sunday evening in London, gloomy, close, and stale. Maddening church bells of all degrees of dissonance, sharp and flat, cracked and clear, fast and slow, made the brick and mortar echoes hideous. Melancholy streets, in a penitential garb of soot, steeped the souls of the people who were condemned to look at them out of windows, in dire despondency. In every thoroughfare, up almost every alley, and down almost every turning, some doleful bell was throbbing, jerking, tolling, as if the plague were in the city, and the dead carts were going round. Everything was bolted and barred that could by possibility furnish relief to an overworked people. No pictures, no unfamiliar animals, no rare plants or flowers, no natural or artificial wonders of the ancient world, all taboo with that enlightened strictness that the ugly South Sea gods in the British Museum might have supposed themselves at home again. Nothing to see but streets, streets, streets. Nothing to breathe but streets, streets, streets. Nothing to change the brooding mind, or raise it up. Nothing for the spent toiler to do, but to compare the monotony of his seventh day with the monotony of his 6 days, think what a weary life he led, and make the best of it or the worst, according to the probabilities. At such a happy time, so propitious to the interests of religion and morality, Mr. Arthur Clennam, newly arrived from Marseille by way of Dover, and by Dover coach the blue-eyed maid, sat in the window of a coffee house on Ludgate Hill. 10,000 responsible houses surrounded him, frowning as heavily on the streets they composed, as if they were every one inhabited by the 10 young men of the calendar story, who blackened their faces, and bemoaned their miseries every night. 50,000 lairs surrounded him, where people lived so unwholesomely that fair water put into their crowded rooms on Saturday night would be corrupt on Sunday morning. Albeit my lord, their county member, was amazed that they failed to sleep in company with their butcher's meat. Miles of close wells and pits of houses, where the inhabitants gasped for air, stretched far away towards every point of the compass. Through the heart of the town a deadly sewer ebbed and flowed, in the place of a fine fresh river. What secular want could the million or so of human beings whose daily labor, 6 days in the week, lay among these Arcadian objects, from the sweet sameness of which they had no escape between the cradle and the grave, what secular want could they possibly have upon their seventh day? Clearly they could want nothing but a stringent policeman. Mr. Arthur Clennam sat in the window of the coffee house on Ludgate Hill, counting one of the neighboring bells, making sentences and burdens of songs out of it in spite of himself, and wondering how many sick people it might be the death of in the course of the year. As the hour approached, its changes of measure made it more and more exasperating. At the quarter, it went off into a condition of deadly lively importunity, urging the populace in a voluble manner to come to church, come to church, come to church. At the 10 minutes, it became aware that the congregation would be scanty, and slowly hammered out in low spirits, "They won't come, they won't come, they won't come." At the 5 minutes, it abandoned hope, and shook every house in the neighborhood for 300 seconds, with one dismal swing per second, as a groan of despair. "Thank heaven!" apostrophe apostrophe said Clennam, when the hour struck, and the bell stopped. But its sound had revived a long train of miserable Sundays, and the procession would not stop with the bell, but continued to march on. "Heaven forgive me," apostrophe said he, "and those who trained me. How I have hated this day." Apostrophe apostrophe, there was the dreary Sunday of his childhood, when he sat with his hands before him, scared out of his senses by a horrible tract which commenced business with the poor child, by asking him in its title, why he was going to perdition. A piece of curiosity that he really, in a frock and drawers, was not in a condition to satisfy, and which, for the further attraction of his infant mind, had a parenthesis in every other line with some such hiccuping reference as to ep. Thess. C.E.V. 6 and 7. There was the sleepy Sunday of his boyhood, when, like a military deserter, he was marched to chapel by a picket of teachers 3 times a day, morally handcuffed to another boy, and when he would willingly have bartered 2 meals of indigestible sermon for another ounce or two of inferior mutton at his scanty dinner in the flesh. There was the interminable Sunday of his nonage, when his mother, stern of face and unrelenting of heart, would sit all day behind a Bible bound, like her own construction of it, in the hardest, barest, and straightest boards, with one dinted ornament on the cover like the drag of a chain, and a wrathful sprinkling of red upon the edges of the leaves as if it, of all books, were a fortification against sweetness of temper, natural affection, and gentle intercourse. There was the resentful Sunday of a little later, when he sat down glowering and glooming through the tardy length of the day, with a sullen sense of injury in his heart, and no more real knowledge of the beneficent history of the New Testament, than if he had been bred among idolaters. There was a legion of Sundays, all days of unserviceable bitterness and mortification, slowly passing before him. "Beg pardon, sir," apostrophe said a brisk waiter, rubbing the table. "Wish see bedroom?" ... "Yes. I have just made up my mind to do it." ... "Chambermaid." ... cried the waiter. "Jill in box num 7 wish see room." ... "Stay. ... said Clennam, rousing himself. "I was not thinking of what I said," I answered mechanically. "I am not going to sleep here. I am going home." ... "Deed, sir?" ... "Chambermaid. Jill in box num 7, not go sleep here, gome." ... He sat in the same place as the day died, looking at the dull houses opposite, and thinking, if the disembodied spirits of former inhabitants were ever conscious of them, how they must pity themselves for their old places of imprisonment. Sometimes a face would appear behind the dingy glass of a window, and would fade away into the gloom, as if it had seen enough of life, and had vanished out of it. Presently the rain began to fall in slanting lines between them and those houses, and people began to collect under cover of the public passage opposite, and to look out hopelessly at the sky as the rain dropped thicker and faster. Then wet umbrellas began to appear, draggled skirts, and mud. What the mud had been doing with itself, or where it came from, who could say? But it seemed to collect in a moment, as a crowd will, and in 5 minutes, to have splashed all the sons and daughters of Adam. The lamplighter was going his rounds now, and as the fiery jets sprang up under his touch, one might have fancied them astonished at being suffered to introduce any show of brightness into such a dismal scene. Mr. Arthur Clennam took up his hat, and buttoned his coat, and walked out. In the country, the rain would have developed 1,000 fresh scents, and every drop would have had its bright association with some beautiful form of growth or life. In the city, it developed only foul stale smells, and was a sickly, lukewarm, dirt-stained, wretched addition to the gutters. He crossed by Street Paul's and went down, at a long angle, almost to the water's edge, through some of the crooked and descending streets which lie and lay more crookedly and closely than, between the river and Cheapside. Passing, now the moldy hall of some obsolete worshipful company, now the illuminated windows of a congregationless church, that seemed to be waiting for some adventurous Bolzoni to dig it out, and discover its history, passing silent warehouses and wharves, and here and there a narrow alley leading to the river, where a wretched little Bill, found drowned, was weeping on the wet wall, he came at last to the house he sought. An old brick house, so dingy as to be all but black, standing by itself within a gateway. Before it, a square courtyard, where a shrub or two and a patch of grass were as rank, which is saying much, as the iron railings enclosing them were rusty. Behind it, a jumble of roots. It was a double house, with long, narrow, heavily framed windows. Many years ago, it had had it in its mind to slide down sideways. It had been propped up, however, and was leaning on some half dozen gigantic crutches. Which gymnasium for the neighboring cats, weather-stained, smoke-blackened, and overgrown with weeds, appeared in these latter days, to be no very sure lions. Nothing changed, apostrophe said the traveler, stopping to look round. Dark and miserable as ever. A light in my mother's window, which seems never to have been extinguished, since I came home twice a year from school, and dragged my box over this pavement. Well, well, well. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he went up to the door, which had a projecting canopy in carved work of festooned jack towels, and children's heads with water on the brain, designed after a once popular monumental pattern, and knocked. A shuffling step was soon heard on the stone floor of the hall, and the door was opened by an old man, bent and dried, but with keen eyes. He had a candle in his hand, and he held it up for a moment, to assist his keen eyes. Ah, Mr. Arthur? Apostrophe he said, without any emotion, you are come at last? Step in. Apostrophe, Mr. Arthur stepped in, and shut the door. Your figure is filled out, and set, apostrophe said the old man, turning to look at him with the light raised again, and shaking his head. But you don't come up to your father in my opinion. Nor yet your mother. Apostrophe, how is my mother? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she is as she always is now. Keeps her room, when not actually bedridden, and hasn't been out of it 15 times in as many years, Arthur. Apostrophe, they had walked into a spare, meager dining room. The old man had put the candlestick upon the table, and, supporting his right elbow with his left hand, was smoothing his leathern jaws, while he looked at the visitor. The visitor offered his hand. The old man took it coldly enough, and seemed to prefer his jaws, to which he returned, as soon as he could. I doubt if your mother will approve of your coming home on the Sabbath, Arthur, apostrophe he said, shaking his head wearily. You wouldn't have me go away again? Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh. I am not the master. It's not what I would have. I have stood between your father and mother for a number of years. I don't pretend to stand between your mother and you. Apostrophe, will you tell her that I have come home? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, Arthur, yes. Oh, to be sure. I'll tell her that you have come home. Please to wait here. You won't find the room changed. Apostrophe, he took another candle from a cupboard, lighted it, left the first on the table, and went upon his errand. He was a short, bald old man, in a high-shouldered black coat and waistcoat, drab breeches, and long drab gaiters. He might, from his dress, have been either clerk or servant, and in fact had long been both. There was nothing about him in the way of decoration but a watch, which was lowered into the depths of its proper pocket by an old black ribbon, and had a tarnished copper key moored above it, to show where it was sunk. His head was awry, and he had a one-sided, crab-like way with him, as if his foundations had yielded at about the same time as those of the house, and he ought to have been propped up in a similar manner. How weak am I, apostrophe said Arthur Clennam, when he was gone, that I could shed tears at this reception. I, who have never experienced anything else, who have never expected anything else. Apostrophe he not only could, but did. It was the momentary yielding of a nature that had been disappointed from the dawn of its perceptions, but had not quite given up all its hopeful yearnings yet. He subdued it, took up the candle, and examined the room. The old articles of furniture were in their old places, the plagues of Egypt, much the dimmer for the fly and smoke plagues of London, were framed and glazed upon the walls. There was the old cellar with nothing in it, lined with lead, like a sort of coffin in compartments. There was the old dark closet, also with nothing in it, of which he had been many a time the sole contents, in days of punishment, when he had regarded it as the veritable entrance to that bourne to which the tract had found him galloping. There was the large, hard-featured clock on the sideboard, which he used to see bending its figured brows upon him with a savage joy, when he was behindhand with his lessons, and which, when it was wound up once a week with an iron handle, used to sound as if it were growling in ferocious anticipation of the miseries into which it would bring him. But here was the old man come back, saying, "Arthur, I'll go before and light you." Apostrophe, Arthur followed him up the staircase, which was paneled off in two spaces like so many morning tablets, into a dim bedchamber, the floor of which had gradually so sunk and settled that the fireplace was in a dell. On a black bier-like sofa in this hollow, propped up behind with one great angular black bolster like the block at a state execution in the good old times, sat his mother in the widow's dress. She and his father had been at variance from his earliest remembrance. To sit speechless himself in the midst of rigid silence, glancing in dread from the one averted face to the other, had been the peacefulest occupation of his childhood. She gave him one glassy kiss, and four stiff fingers muffled in worsted. This embrace concluded, he sat down on the opposite side of her little table. There was a fire in the grate, as there had been night and day for 15 years. There was a kettle on the hob, as there had been night and day for 15 years. There was a little mound of damp ashes on the top of the fire, and another little mound swept together under the grate, as there had been night and day for 15 years. There was a smell of black dye in the airless room, which the fire had been drawing out of the crepe and stuff of the widow's dress for 15 months, and out of the bier-like sofa for 15 years. Mother, this is a change from your old active habits. Apostrophe, the world has narrowed to these dimensions, Arthur, apostrophe, she replied, glancing round the room. It is well for me that I never set my heart upon its hollow vanities. Apostrophe, the old influence of her presence and her stern strong voice, so gathered about her son, that he felt conscious of a renewal of the timid chill and reserve of his childhood. Do you never leave your room, mother? Apostrophe, apostrophe, what with my rheumatic affection, and what with its attendant debility or nervous weakness names are of no matter now I have lost the use of my limbs. I never leave my room. I have not been outside this door for tell him for how long, apostrophe she said, speaking over her shoulder. A dozen year next Christmas, apostrophe returned a cracked voice out of the dimness behind. Is that Affery? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Arthur, looking towards it. The cracked voice replied that it was Affery. And an old woman came forward into what doubtful light there was, and kissed her hand once, then subsided again into the dimness. I am able, apostrophe said Mrs. Clennam, with a slight motion of her worsted muffled right hand toward a chair on wheels, standing before a tall writing cabinet close shut up, I am able to attend to my business duties, and I am thankful for the privilege. It is a great privilege. But no more of business on this day. It is a bad night, is it not? Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.